This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talked to attorney Jan Sussler on the campaign to free Puerto Rican political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera. He's the longest serving Puerto Rican political prisoner, 34 years, and he's part of that struggle to decolonize and make Puerto Rico independent. We asked the question, is there an ongoing genocide in the Middle East?
Today we'll talk to Hannibal Travis about what's happening in Syria, Iraq, what the West is doing about it, and what the Israelis have done to the Palestinians.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, as the father of a famous folk singer impresario, Eli Smith, I know you have a special interest in the kind of music that Eli plays. And one of, I know, Eli's inspiration was a group called The Weavers. And recently, sadly, there was a death of one of the original Weavers, a woman named Ronnie Gilbert. And we'll play a song from her at the end, but can you tell us a little bit about Ronnie Gilbert and The Weavers?
Well, Ronnie Gilbert died 2 weeks ago at age 88. Out in Mill Valley, California. She was a founder of the Weavers, along with Pete Seeger, Fred Hellerman, and Lee Hayes. They had the most popular song in the country, as you reminded me, Michael. Goodnight Irene, I think back in 1952, was number one on the charts.
Why, I don't know. I mean, it's a nice song and all, but I mean, you know, how do you compare that to, like, you know, Lead Belly or, well, you know, Chubby Checker?
They learned it from Lead Belly. What happened was the group was about to break up. Max Gordon, who ran the Village Vanguard, a jazz club on 7th Avenue, which still exists, offered them a two-week gig over Christmas. And they took the gig, and they wound up staying there for many weeks. And then
they being the Weavers, right?
The Weavers, yeah.
Just give an aside, who were the members of the Weavers?
Well, as I said, Ronnie Gilbert was the lead female singer. Pete Seeger became the most famous of the Weavers. And there was Fred Hellerman and Lee Hayes. And after that, they got a record deal, and they became one of the main popular singing groups in America. Then came the Blacklist, and Pete Seeger had been a member of the Communist Party. The other three had been around the Communist Party. Ronnie Gilbert's parents were radicals, one from Russia, one from the Ukraine. Father worked in the garment industry. Her mother was a big influence on her. They were all leftists, and they were blacklisted, and they couldn't work anywhere. So I wanted to tell you a story about that, Michael. I was in high school in 1957. This is a couple of years after the Weavers are blacklisted. The only course other than gym that I did any good in was history. The history teacher liked me.
You repeated that year, as I recall. Right?
I barely got through high school. But the history teacher invited me over to his apartment. I brought over my friend Sue.
Today we
and we went up to his room. He lived in a rooming house, and we were sitting on the bed. He said, "I'm going to show you something, but you have to promise me that you won't tell anybody." So wow. I said, "Okay." And he leaned over, and he reached down, and he pulled out from under his bed a Weavers album. And that's when I first heard the song Union Miners, which we're going to play for you in a minute. But that's how repressive things were then. And Ronnie Gilbert stuck it out through the 50s, the 60s. She continued active as a singer and then as a psychologist, moved out to California. When gay marriage became legal, the mayor of San Francisco allowed it for a little bit, and she and her companion got married out there. And she lived to the ripe old age of 88, a real tribute to the human spirit. So we say, Ronnie, farewell and thank you. And we want to share one of my favorite Weavers songs with you right now, Union Miners.
Union Miners stand together. Heed no operator's tale. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale. In conclusion, bear in memory, keep this password in your mind. God provides for every worker
divine. Then by honest weights we'll labor. Union miners will prevail. So keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale. Union miners, stand together. Heed no operator's tale. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale.
Made it, by God.
That was the Weavers singing Union Miners, featuring the gorgeous contralto voice of Ronnie Gilbert. Michael, Iraqi single mother has assembled an international team of lawyers who are now asking the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, that's out in California, to hear her claim that the Iraq War was illegal under laws set down at the Nuremberg trials, which govern when and how a country can go to war. What's your take on this lawsuit, its possibilities of success, your experience in this, and whether or not you think that the war in Iraq was in fact an aggressive war?
Well, generally, I like any kind of ferment and opposition to U.S. war making. But also generally, if I look at my own career, it's not my failure, but it's one area where we've had absolutely no impact on the most aggressive imperial country in the world, the one King called the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And I've brought 15 lawsuits like this, similar, starting with my office started in Vietnam, and then we went, a half a dozen or more in Central America, maybe more, did Grenada, did the first Iraq War, finally decided not to do this Iraq War because while there were good movements behind us when we brought these suits and they were worthwhile as an issue to talk about, this was illegal, particularly at the time they were going on. We were just beaten down so badly in the courts that we said, okay, our resources have to be put somewhere else. We've done as much as we can with this.
Let me ask you this. It was clear to us, Michael, when at the lead-up of the war, that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction. So that was clear to us, that they had no connection with al-Qaeda. And Bush and Cheney and Rummy kept lying, saying they did. It was clear to us. And you still decided it was a loser? Why?
Well, there's two things going on here. One is, even if they had weapons of mass destruction, that wouldn't be a reason to make a war on them. I mean, Pakistan has weapons of mass destruction. I mean, India has weapons of mass destruction. That doesn't mean you go to war against those countries. So even that is just, a bunch of junk. But they didn't have it, so it was a lie, and it was sold to the American people on a lie. And what the lawsuit is based on, and I think it got some publicity recently because Ramsey Clark came in with an amicus brief, which is a friend of the court, on the appeal. The case lost in the lower court. It's on appeal in the Ninth Circuit. And it's, as you said, by an Iraqi woman and who says the war is illegal. And she's basing it on the principles of Nuremberg. And that's correct, because Nuremberg, while everybody thinks about, the Holocaust and the 6 million Jews killed, yes, that's right, of course. But that wasn't the essence or the nub of what happened at Nuremberg. The essence and the main piece of it was the making of aggressive war, was going after Hitler and Germany for aggressive war, which is to say war without justification. And that was considered by the Nuremberg Tribunal and by the Americans who participated in that, including our Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Justice Jackson, who considered aggressive war to be the supreme international crime.
Why is that?
And I'll say it again, supreme international crime, because it embodies every other crime. When you make an aggressive war, you're killing people. You're destroying everybody's homes. You're committing all kinds of rape. Everything happens within a war. And this is an illegal, unauthorized war. So it's the supreme crime because, yes, torture happens. Yes, mass murder happens in a war. But it's the supreme crime because that all happens in a war. So rather than you go after the individual crimes, but you go after the key aggressive war. We all knew at the time of the Iraq war, and there was at least one lawsuit brought that I recall out of Boston, maybe two, that labeled this what it was, as did we in our publications. I actually wrote a short book against the Iraq war before it even began, talking about this as the supreme international crime. That's what it is. And of course, we see today, as we live through ISIS and everything else, what this caused in terms of murder, killing, destabilization, etc. Getting back to the lawsuit for a second. So they file in the district court in the West, but eventually goes to the Ninth Circuit, which is the court in, I think it's California now, it's the Ninth Circuit, but it's out in the West, or Colorado. They file that appeal, and Ramsey Clark comes in along with a man named Ferenz from a small thing called the Small Planet Foundation. His father, interestingly enough, was one of the key prosecutors in Nuremberg. So he's always been on this issue of trying to outlaw aggressive war. Now, I should say, in terms of outlawing aggressive war, there's Nuremberg, but there's also the UN Charter. The UN Charter came after Nuremberg, 1948, and it said there's only two ways you can use war. One is if you're attacked, directly attacked, then you can have a right to defend yourself. And the second way is if the UN Security Council authorizes the war. Of course, that didn't happen here. You need a UN Security Council resolution to authorize war. There's no other way to make it. What Bush was doing from Jump Street was illegal. So what this woman did, or this Iraqi woman and some others perhaps, did was sue Bush, Cheney, and the people who told the lies to get us into this war. And she sued them for damages under basically the Nuremberg law and its international law and under the law of the UN Charter, which is the law that the U.S. has ratified. So a court should hear it and listen to this case. It's a damage case against officials who have killed hundreds of thousands, perhaps more, Iraqis.
Yeah, but Michael, the court below said you can't do this because Bush and Cheney have immunity. What about immunity in the Nuremberg principles? Wasn't that raised in Nuremberg?
Right. I mean, they, unfortunately, well, I don't want to predict, but generally we've lost every single one of these cases in large part because of holdings by American courts that the officials who authorized this illegal conduct are immune from suit because they were acting in the name of the United States, and therefore, under special statutes that have been passed, they're completely immune from suit.
Yeah, but the Germans said the same thing, that everything that the Germans did in Germany was done legally.
Right. So the answer to your question is at Nuremberg, there was no doctrine of immunity allowed, and they didn't get to take the doctrine of immunity. And the answer also is, if you look at the International Criminal Court, which prosecutes people for various crimes, not aggressive war, interestingly, we'll talk about that in a second, there is no immunity. And if you look at the Convention Against Torture, which says that every official who tortures someone is liable as an international crime or a crime, the opening phrase is, there's no immunity. You can't, whether you're a king, a president, you cannot torture. So the U.S. flies directly in the face of international law by saying our officials can kill people, murder people, make an aggressive war, and yet be immune from lawsuit. It's just outside the law. They're wrong. But my guess is that this court will go in that direction, probably hold these officials immune, as they've done in a dozen of our Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuits. Now, going for a second back to the outlawing of aggressive war, Nuremberg outlawed it. That's clear. Justice Jackson, who was Chief Judge of the Supreme Court serving at Nuremberg, said that, as I said, that's a supreme international crime. You then have the UN Charter, law of the United States it is, saying you can't make war except in the two instances I said, Security Council or self-defense. And then you have the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court, you know, last couple of decades has jurisdiction over, you know, genocide, over torture, various war crimes, disappearances, etc. And it has in there the words war of aggression, but it has no definition of war of aggression. and it so far is not a crime you can actually bring into the International Criminal Court. Now, Ferenz, who's one of the lawyers in this case on an amicus brief, he's been pushing for years. This is his big issue of his little foundation, is to get the International Criminal Court to define, and the nations of the world, to define aggressive war. But he has not succeeded. And my guess is it's going to be almost impossible to succeed. And the reason for that, it's obvious. The U.S. in particular, but other countries in the world, they make aggressive war constantly. For them, it's like me crossing the street, you know, to go into the West Village. I mean, they go, look what the U.S. has done, even under Obama. What did we call the war against Libya? That the U.S. bombed the heck out of Libya, destroyed the country, and then with no approval from the U.S. Congress. So that's an aggressive war. What Obama's doing all over the country with the drones, outside of ongoing wars that may or may not have been authorized, drones in Yemen, unauthorized war, aggressive war, all of that. So the U.S. does this, you know, as King Well said, we got to get rid of militarism. And again, we're talking about the greatest purveyor of violence in the world.
There's been a long struggle by Puerto Ricans here in the United States for the independence of their native land, Puerto Rico. Oscar Lopez Rivera was one of these people. He was framed up on the political charge of seditious conspiracy and has been in prison since the 80s. All his co-defendants in the original trial have now been freed, but he remains locked up, and there is a campaign going on in the United States now to free Oscar Lopez Rivera. Chicago attorney Jan Sussler is a partner in the People's Law Office in that city. She's a longtime litigator in support of Puerto Rican political prisoners. And she is a central activist in the campaign to free Puerto Rican political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera. Lopez Rivera is in prison in Indiana. He served 34 years, 12 of them in solitary, and he's one of the longest held political prisoners in the world. Chicago attorney Jan Sussler, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Jan, historically you've been associated with the Puerto Rican independence movement, and I know you're an active supporter of Oscar Lopez Rivera. And would you please tell us a little bit about who is Oscar Lopez Rivera?
Right. Oscar's been in prison for 34 years, convicted of seditious conspiracy, which is really an overtly political charge.
Seditious conspiracy. Why is that such a political charge?
Well, I mean, it even sounds like it, right?
It
translates to, for the layperson, conspiring to use force against the lawful authority of the United States over Puerto Rico. And the charge really was used exclusively against people fighting for Puerto Rican independence between 1930 and 1980.
So when you say conspire, you could be thinking about it and talking to other people about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. You have to agree with, you know, one or more people to be part of this conspiracy. And that's what the conspiracy is exactly what you said. You just have to think about it or agree. It doesn't mean you did anything. And in fact, when the judge was instructing the jury in the trials of Oscar and his co-defendants, he actually said to the jury, you don't have to find that they ever did anything, just that they agreed to be part of this organization, which was called the FALN, the Armed Forces for National Liberation. And so 34 years later, Oscar is in prison without having been convicted of hurting or killing anyone.
I remember seditious conspiracy, and it's just as you said.
Yeah.
It can be used technically against anybody who, you know, has a quote, conspires to overthrow a government or whatever.
Well, it's an insidious charge.
Right, but it was only used against Puerto Rico. I mean,
For 50 years?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's the only time it was ever used. I was always completely floored by that.
Which, actually, under the U.S. Constitution, is unconstitutional because it's what they call selective enforcement. You can't just have a statute that you use against one individual or group. But that's what they did, and he's been in prison for 34 years.
Well, let's talk about him before he got to prison, about who this man is, because he was quite an impressive community organizer, actually, in Chicago. Tell us about what he was doing, and then I wanted to ask you about what the problem was that he and his group perceived about America's relations with Puerto Rico.
Yes, because that is something that most of us who live in the United States really are kept ignorant about. But Oscar's 72 years old now. Back, let's, you know, roll the camera back and rewind. In the 60s, he was drafted into the U.S. Army and was an infantryman in Vietnam, which is really where he sort of started to gain his understanding politically about the injustices that the U.S. was committing. And he got to know a lot of other Puerto Rican soldiers, and ultimately he returned from Vietnam. He was a decorated veteran. He got a Bronze Star. But his community was really devastated by segregation, hatred, poverty. And he just sort of rolled up his sleeves and started working and tried to better the environment, housing, police brutality, bilingual education, employment. He was in the school of Saul Alinsky, that type of community organizer, which incidentally President Obama claims to be.
I knew you were going to say that.
And they were very successful, and they got recruitment programs in the universities, and they got the public utilities to hire Latinos in the construction industry, and the banks to give loans for houses. And I mean, really, it was kind of trying to transform social environment for people who were otherwise excluded, Puerto Ricans and other Latinos and African Americans. His understanding of who he was politically ultimately led him to the independence movement, and the repression ultimately led to a clandestine organization, which was really what was going on in very much in the world, starting in Africa to oust the European colonizers, and all over Latin America as well. So Puerto Rico, being a Latin American and Caribbean country and a colony of the United States, had a very long and proud history of fighting for its independence, including from Spain, which was the colonizer before the U.S. took over and invaded in 1898. So you kind of have to see him in the context of this very rich history of a people who fight to maintain their identity and control their own destiny.
Well, what did it mean for Puerto Rico to be a colony of the United States, and how many colonies are there in the world today?
Well, in terms of Puerto Rico, it's a very odd relationship that even people in the Congress don't quite grasp. Under Supreme Court opinions, Puerto Rico belongs to but is not part of the United States. And it's a very, they imposed citizenship on U.S. On Puerto Ricans in 1917, right before the draft for World War I. Puerto Ricans have served very disproportionately in the U.S. military. It means they don't control their borders. It means that because they're situated geographically between Latin America and the U.S., they happen to be a spot where drugs are run through. The Puerto Rican people have no control over that, and the U.S. doesn't finance it well enough. And so it means that Puerto Rico is ravaged with drugs and guns. It means they don't control shipping. They have to use U.S. ships and U.S. staffed ships to bring all the goods to the country, which means it's way more expensive. Venezuela wanted to sell Puerto Rico oil at an affordable rate. They're not allowed to make an international contract like that. They don't control their own stamps. They don't control the price of a lot of goods. They don't get to control their own destiny. Basically, yeah. That's what it means.
I was surprised at how expensive things were there. But what's like the level of human development in Puerto Rico as compared to other places in the United States?
Human development meaning?
Well, education, health, life expectancy, infant mortality.
In the diaspora, in the Puerto Rican community and in Puerto Rico, you'll find what you do in most of the other occupied territories in the world. The rate of alcoholism has skyrocketed. The underemployment and unemployment is outrageous. Diabetes, cancer, people suffer them at rates far greater than the white population of the U.S. I mean, it's what you would expect of a colony. On the other hand, Puerto Rican people have struggled to maintain their culture and their identity. There are wonderful cultural institutions and brilliant people. Many of the engineers that work at NASA are educated in Puerto Rican state universities. There are doctors, many of whom are fleeing now because the U.S. controls the economy, and the economy is in dire, dire trouble. You know, if Puerto Rico could control its own destiny, I could guarantee you that things would be different because they're a very resourceful, creative, and powerful people.
Getting back to Oscar Lopez Rivera, I understand that he's among the longest-held political prisoners in the world. And wasn't there an effort to get him out back in 1999 under Clinton? And then let me ask you about the effort today and what we can do to help.
Sure. Yes. And ever since they were sent to prison, he and his co-defendants have had worldwide support. In 1999, President Clinton, in a gesture acknowledging that support, offered clemency, executive clemency, to Oscar and his co-defendants. The grant to Oscar was very different from that to others. It was to serve another 10 years and to ensure that he not have any prison infractions. And the other thing that was important in that clemency offer of President Clinton was that it wasn't offered to all of the co-defendants. And Oscar, just as he did in Vietnam when he was awarded the Bronze Star, said, I'm not going to accept the offer. I think everyone else should. They made a collective decision, and he decided to stay behind until everyone else was out. Now everyone else is out. They served 16 and 20 and 30 years, different varieties of his co-defendants. They've all been living successful, productive, law-abiding lives in Puerto Rico and in different cities in the U.S., and Oscar's the only one left. And there's a really vibrant and growing campaign for his release. In Puerto Rico, which is a very divided society politically, in part because of the whole colonial question, there's a division between people who want independence, people who want to maintain the status quo, and people who want Puerto Rico to become the 51st state of the U.S. They don't usually agree on anything, and they all agree that Oscar should come home. The governor, who supports the status quo, went to prison to visit Oscar, and proudly had his photo taken with him, came back and wrote a column in the main daily newspaper saying, this man is not a danger to anyone. It is time for him to come home. He's gone to the Justice Department and the White House and said the same thing. The churches, bar associations, the universities, there's a clamor for his release in Puerto Rico. That is echoed in the region, in Latin America, and throughout the world. We just got a letter from many Swedish legislators and parliamentarians calling on the president for his release, and Nobel laureates. And now in the U.S., not just now, but we just marked the 34th anniversary of his arrest. There was a big march, which actually Heidi attended through in Harlem, supporting Oscar's release with over 3,000 people. And the Hispanic ministers, senators, assemblymen, U.S. Congress people, and lots of public organizations. The teachers union from the CUNY, students, community organizations. It was really, really a wonderful march. And he's going to be honored in the Puerto Rican Day Parade that's coming up in New York. The Bronx Parade was dedicated to him. I mean, it's And other cities as well. So we're really hoping that President Obama will exercise his constitutional power of pardon. He could sign today if he wanted to. And he understands this is something that not just the Puerto Rican people want, but that people who care about justice want.
Yeah, you would think that after 34 years in prison, 12 of them in solitary in a maxi-max prison, there'd be some compassion here. But from what you described, and I've been following it also, there's a real wave of support that's gathering for Oscar. And how does one keep in touch with that? Is there a website? What would you advise our
sure.
listeners to do?
Yes. You can go to BoricuaHumanRights.org. It's BORICUA, HumanRights.org, all run together. And there you can find a sample letter if you're so inclined to write a letter to President Obama from your organization or your church or your as an individual. He needs to hear from all of us so that he understands this is something he's supposed to do. The president really has accumulated an embarrassingly abysmal record in the exercise of this constitutional power of pardon. And this is certainly one way that he can help rectify that. And he needs to be encouraged. He needs to hear from us all.
You bet. Attorney Jan Sussler from the People's Law Office in Chicago, we thank you very much for all your good work over the many years, particularly in support of the Puerto Rican people, and for your good work now in support of Oscar Lopez Rivera. And thank you so much for being a guest on Law and Disorder.
So glad to be with you, and hopefully soon you can interview Oscar.
Absolutely.
Thanks all right. again. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I. Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Ooh, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs.
Here on Law and Disorder, on a number of shows, we've discussed genocide. Genocide, of course, most recently we've discussed with our co-host whose family was affected by the Armenian genocide. We've discussed that genocide. We've also discussed the question of whether what has happened to Palestinians in the Middle East also constitutes genocide. And there's much discussion about that. We've discussed other instances of claimed genocides as well. Today, we're glad to have with us Hannibal Travis, who's an expert on genocide, particularly genocides in the Middle East and Africa. His book is called Genocide in the Middle East, the Ottoman Empire, Iraq, and Sudan. He'll bring us up to date first on the definition of genocide, how that word is used in various struggles and contexts, whether committing genocide against a people's culture would come within the legal definition. We'll talk with him about whether what the Israelis did to the Palestinians was genocide, and he'll also talk about what's happening to minority populations, particularly in Iraq and Syria, and the desperation and jeopardy those populations are in. Hannibal Travis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you with us. We know you're an expert on genocides, but in particular, your book is titled, and it's an area of specialty for you, I know, Genocide in the Middle East, the Ottoman Empire, Iraq, and Sudan. And while I haven't read it, I looked through it online, and it's quite fascinating because it begins really with how do we get to what genocide means? What does it mean? Were there mass killings before? When did that happen, and how did the law evolve? So let's start with that.
Right. So I decided to write the book that way because many books sort of start out with an assumption of what genocide is, and then they try to fit the historical evidence into it one way or another. But oftentimes their definition does not exactly match what the legal definition is. So I go into some detail about what the drafting of the Genocide Convention was intended to do by Raphael Lemkin and others, what the international tribunals have said, you know, since about 1998 with the Akayesu case and some of the cases arising out of Bosnia, and to some extent the International Criminal Court. And then what do scholars say? And there's different scholarly theories. But what is it in general? Raphael Lemkin conceived of genocide as replacing the national pattern of a group with somebody else's national pattern, sort of like erasure and replacement of a group. And he was often thinking about Poland. So the Germans were invading Poland and killing the Polish intelligentsia. And, of course, exterminating all the Jews, and then they were going to settle Poland with German farmers and enslave the Poles and then enslave the Russians and settle Russia. And this whole process he thought of as genocide. So I kind of look at it that way. There's some support for that in what the UN did in 1948, but there's an ongoing scholarly controversy about it, to make the story short.
Let me ask you a question about that. I'm familiar with it because, you know, I'm an international human rights lawyer, and of course Lemkin was Jewish from a town outside or near Bialystok, Poland, got out of the war, etc., so we had a real deep interest in this, obviously. But the definition had, as I recall, now four key words in it, the eventual UN definition, and it excluded other kinds of things like political, you know, killing people for political reasons, as I recall, but I don't remember. So can you just remind our listeners what the four categories are?
National, racial, ethnical, and religious groups.
So if you're killing someone for a group for political reasons, that wouldn't come necessarily within that definition. Is that right?
There's a very interesting book about this called Genocide and Political Groups, and it kind of draws on previous books. It's by David Narcissian. And the controversy is, on the one hand, a political group is also a national group always. So like when the Khmer Rouge started killing all the perceived capitalists and Westerners in Cambodia, you could call that a national genocide as well as a political genocide or a politicide. And the Cambodians, when the regime changed, they actually convicted Pol Pot and the others in absentia for genocide. Then the UN and the US and others sort of recognized it as a genocide, even though a lot of it was kind of political. It was also religious. You know, they were targeting the Kham Muslims, and it was also kind of ethnical. They were targeting the Vietnamese Cambodians. But it's often cited as an example of a political genocide that you can fit into the national category. So there's an ongoing controversy, but there's some evidence also in the drafting process that people regarded slaying the national elite, political elite, as a type of national genocide. So what Lemkin was talking about with the Polish Poles, the non-Jewish Poles.
I'm going to jump ahead for a second and then go back to why you wrote this book, particularly on genocides in the Middle East, and it's the only book like it, I think, because I want to deepen a little bit the understanding of genocide. Let's take the example, and there may be other ways this can be defined as genocide, what happened to the Kurds in Iraq. And part of it, as I recall, was they weren't allowed to speak their language, they weren't allowed to do a number of other things. And so I want to ask you about the issue of cultural genocide, without necessarily killing the people, but prohibiting customs, language, really trying to destroy their culture, essentially. You have any thoughts about that? I'm sure you do.
So they decided when they drafted the convention, there was going to be an Article 3 called cultural genocide that was aimed directly at language and literature and libraries and you know, religious institutions and stuff like that. They didn't put it in. It was written kind of extremely broadly. Ironically, it was written by Syria. And the problem with it was, you know, if you have like a national educational system or an Anglican church, you know, what does that do? Are you committing genocide? So they didn't put that in. However, what they did say is, you know, you take the children away from the native indigenous people and you raise them as Christians or Muslims or whatever, that could be a genocide under Article 2E.
That's really interesting to me because, of course, recently we see, of course, until 1998 in Australia, the indigenous people were forced out of their communities, and in the United States, of course, as well with our Indian people. But anyway.
Right, and there have been reports in Australia and Canada, sort of governmental reports, not at the highest level, but at a commission-type level, saying that those were sort of stolen children genocides. And when they were drafting the convention, they really had in mind, ironically, the Greek communists kidnapping children and raising them as child soldier communists. So it's applicable to ISIS, really, in a way, and other Lord's Resistance Army and Boko Haram and stuff like that. Sorry about that. But the other part of cultural genocide is at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, they have some case law that says if you destroy the mosques in Bosnia in order that the Muslim group will not return once they become refugees, that can be used to infer genocidal intent because you're not just waging a war, you're trying to destroy the group.
That raises another point, another question I have, because it was interesting to me. I never heard that before. Israel destruction of Palestinian, whether it's mosques or villages within Palestine, that would seem analogous to what you just said.
It's interesting because it's a case that's often raised in the UN by the Arab League, you know, by Turkey, by Iran and others. And, you know, if you take a very broad definition and if you believe that a large number of mosques were destroyed, then you could see where they're coming from. I tend to think that if you take the Israeli actions in aggregate, it does not support a genocidal intent because the number of Palestinians has grown dramatically. They still have their language. They still have their religion. They still have mosques. There were battles in which, you know, maybe mosques were destroyed and maybe some of them were destroyed on purpose to drive the group away, especially in 1948. But is it really qualitatively different than the United States destroying churches in Germany or even in Japan through just massive bombing, which is typically not called a genocide because they had some kind of military objective in the area? I think actually it's much smaller than, you know, the bombing of Dresden or Hamburg or something like that, or Hiroshima, that you see the ruins of the church there. So, you know, if you look at that decision not to charge that as genocide, then what Israel did is, of course, much smaller than that.
It's smaller, but the difference to me is, just to get into this a little bit, is the difference is the Germans weren't going to be driven out of Germany when their churches were destroyed. In this case, from people like Benny Morris forward to Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, the books go through extensive material of the knowing pushing out of Palestinians and partly by this method. And that seems different to me. It's not the quantity, it's more the intent of trying to make sure the Palestinians don't go back. The Germans were always going to go back to Berlin or Cologne or wherever it was.
I think there was some difference of opinion on that between the Irgun and the Jewish Agency, where there were actually invitations of Arabs to stay. And originally there was an offer, which I believe was accepted, you know, that they have quite a large half or even more than half of Mandate Palestine. And then, you know, after the war, sort of the Irgun was maybe disempowered and the Arab population grew dramatically. So it's not like the Turkish Christian population, which is less than 1%. If you take the Arab percentage of Mandate Palestine, it's much, much larger than 20%. So I find it difficult to infer an intention to remove the Arab group when the percentage remains so high.
Well, let me say, that's, you know, you're into an area that actually your two hosts know a great deal about, and there's a huge amount written on that. And even Benny Morris, who was the revisionist historian who first brought up, you know, from an Israeli point of view, the cleansing of the villages, as new evidence has unfolded, has had to revise his opinion about the intentional driving out of Palestinians, and now coming to the conclusion that even on the level of Ben-Gurion, there was certainly a plan to do that before. How it was carried out in the field was somewhat disputed, but in fact, a lot of the plan was actually carried out. So there was an intent to actually cleanse parts of Mandate Palestine of Palestinians.
And going back to Germany, actually 10 million Germans were driven out of Greater Germany. If you include, like, you know, Ostkommissariat and, you know, occupied Europe as Germany, as Third Reich Germany, 10 million were deported and 2 million died during the deportation. So that's much larger than the Palestinian Arab casualties or deportations, and not considered an allied or a Soviet genocide of the Germans.
Yeah, it's not. But, you know, in talking about genocide, I'll push you on this. It's not really numbers that are the critical issue. I mean, if an Indian population of a tribe is, you know, 50,000, and you go into that area and just wipe out the tribe, that's genocide, whether it's 50,000 or 10 million, right? I mean,
well, the tribunals do talk about a quantitative criterion. They talk about quantitative and qualitative. So Nersesian goes into this in an interesting way. And, you know, you could have 50,000 Chinese dying in war with the United States. It wouldn't be quantitatively significant as a percentage, but it would be larger than, let's say, there's an uncontacted tribe in the Amazon, and the government says, hey, kill the tribe, and half of them run off, and half of them are killed, and, you know, it's 50 people. It's 50%, but it's much less than your 50,000 Chinese.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The number is, as you said, is qualitative and quantitative.
Yeah, so the number is relevant, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a high number, but it does have to be. You know, the Yugoslav tribunal have said that 2% may be too low. There were some cases where there was a camp population, you know, these famous Bosnian Serb concentration camps. And when they calculated the number of people who were killed, it was like 2% of the region or something like that. And they said, that's not enough. It indicates you wanted the people to survive rather than die if they're in your power and 98% survive. If you apply that to Israel and 98% of the Arabs survive, it tends to suggest, you know, they're equally or less genocidal than this guy who was acquitted by the Yugoslav tribunal.
Yeah, well, I've read the statements of the leaders of the Zionist movement going all the way back to the early days, and their intent really was to replace the Arab population with the Jewish population. And that was kind of an undercurrent of all their statements. And fortunately, they didn't slaughter people like happened in other places. But they did replace, they did expel some 750,000 in 1948 and kept them out there. You know, they're still refugees. But Hannibal, I wanted to switch the topic, if I might, and remind our listeners, we're speaking with Hannibal Travis, who's a professor of law at Florida International University. He's written a book called Genocide in the Middle East. And I wanted to ask you about what's going on currently in the Middle East, and how would you describe that, and ask you what the United Nations might be able to do with respect to it?
You know, so currently, Russia, the Vatican, Lebanon, Iraq have all said that there's a genocide by the insurgency and the rebellion in Iraq and Syria, led by ISIS, but ISIS also works with other people, including the Nusra Front and so-called Free Syrian Army. And basically, the tactic is to, you know, kidnap and enslave, you know, Christian and Yazidi women, set off bombs in marketplaces, killing as many people as they have the technology to kill. They're developing weapons of mass destruction to do even more. But the UN has really failed to act. They put this on an agenda item called technical assistance to the government of Iraq. Whereas in other cases like Palestine, they have a special session on atrocities in Palestine or something like that. So, you know, of course, the Christian population of Iraq has decreased by more than two-thirds since 2003, from about maybe 750,000 to a million to about 250,000 to 300,000. It could be less than 250,000. We don't really know at this point. And the Yazidis, of course, are President Obama called that a genocide and said that ISIS is trying to either kill or enslave them. So the Secretary General and his representative for genocide prevention has the opportunity to, call for some kind of a safe haven or a mass evacuation of these people. I would support a mass evacuation because I think that a safe haven will not be defensible. If you look at the territory on the map, it's sort of surrounded by desert and there's no clear natural border and then there's no international troops who want to volunteer for such a mission. Probably the most dangerous part of the world right now. So I would say that, you know, there should be an evacuation to Western countries and there should be a quota system to take them, to take families. kind of like we had the opportunity to do during the Holocaust and as was done during the Armenian Genocide, saving the remnant of the Armenian nation.
How many people are we talking about?
I think we are probably, there used to be 500,000 Yazidis, but I think after 2007, there was a series of truck bombs in one of their major towns that killed about 400 to 500 people. I think a lot of them might have fled after that. So maybe there are 300,000 to 400,000 Yazidis and 250,000 to 350,000 Christians.
And you're suggesting that they be moved out of that area. Is that it?
Yeah, I think the area is not defensible. There's a huge state there that wants to exterminate and enslave them. And it's really a case of, with the Vatican and other people have called it the extinction of an entire people or two peoples.
Here's the question for you. I mean, I think it's intriguing and it's being pushed, and I would bring us up to date on what's actually happening with the UN, but it's impossible to get anybody to take almost any refugees. Where are you going to put 500,000, 400,000 people? I mean, you see how Europe is going nuts over, quotas and all of this. Where are you going to, or you have to set up some huge refugee camp, and you've probably visited, as I have, refugee camps that go on for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. I mean, none of us have the answer. I'm not pushing on that. I'm just really interested in how this is ever going to happen.
Well, I think, if you look at the Armenian case, people talk about 800,000 Armenian refugees being absorbed into various places. And also the Greeks, there were about a million Greeks who between 1913 and 1924 fled to either Greece, Europe, or somewhere else and were absorbed. And that was when they had a lot less technology and money than today. A lot of these countries were experiencing a famine themselves, like Russia and maybe Greece, I don't know. And then after 1948, of course, you have the refugee camps in Lebanon and Syria and so forth. If you look at pictures of the Yarmouk refugee camp in Syria before Al-Qaeda took it over, it was like a normal city. It looked better than Detroit. So if it's good enough for Americans to live in, it's good enough for refugees.
Yeah, that's Yarmouk, but of course, Lebanon is another story. Those refugee camps are awful. But the question, so I understand what you're saying, but those have been going on for, now it's, 67 years. For the camps in Lebanon. Has any country indicated they're willing to even step forward for 10,000 refugees, much less 100,000? I mean, or 400,000? Or any countries? Is there any movement on this?
There are people who pay lip service to this. I mean, the United States talked about 30,000 Iraqi refugees back in 2008, and I think a lot of them actually were admitted and came in. But I think a lot of them were Muslims or Kurds or Muslim Kurds. So it didn't really serve the purpose of saving what Congress called the minorities of antiquity or the religious minorities. There was going to be Senator Kennedy supported a religious minority refugee category, kind of like a Cuban refugee category or a Nicaraguan Adjustment Act or a Haitian protected status and all this kind of stuff that we have. But I believe that the Republicans and maybe some Democrats like Hillary Clinton, they wanted Iraq to look like a success. So if they said, well, the Christians are being exterminated and we need to evacuate them, it sort of undermines their narrative. So they blocked it. And then they make a big show of, oh, we support human rights and saving Iraq. And they refuse to even allow the refugees in who are pro-American, who, are victims of America's enemies. Meanwhile, some of these same senators are supporting indirectly America's enemies through the Free Syrian Army.
So, Hanabal, what about the current situation with the UN in Iraq and Syria? What might we expect from that body?
Not much, unfortunately. I mean, the Secretary General's office has taken the positive step of inviting the Assyrian Aid Society to meet with them to discuss this issue. So hopefully something will come out of that. But there are all these voting blocks that are an impediment to having effective action, and they always want to have a special session or a focus on Israel alone, to the exclusion of the Kurds or the Yazidis or the Christians of Iraq or Syria or the Sri Lankan Tamils or whatever else is going on just gets ignored. And, unfortunately, I think this voting bloc will always be there, even if the Secretary General is well-intentioned. And then we have the Western countries, David Cameron and Barack Obama and so forth, and they're conflicted because while you know, they often have good intentions and provide humanitarian aid and condemn genocide of the Yazidis and so forth and so on. You know, they don't want to make the whole area seem like a basket case that's somehow attributable to their policy.
The title of your book, Genocide in the Middle East, the Ottoman Empire, Iraq, and Sudan, is, and as the blurb says, it's really the only book on the genocides in Africa and the Middle East. As we close up this segment, can you give us some sense of the lessons you learned by writing that book and what's new or different about those genocides than others we may have heard of in other parts of the world?
One commonality I found that was really striking procedurally or structurally is the Ministry of the Interior took the lead in the Ottoman Empire, in Ba'athist or Saddam Hussein Iraq, and in Sudan under al-Bashir, is that the uprising or the perceived uprising of the Armenians, the Kurds, and the Darfurians, the Fur and the Masalit peoples, was seen to be a threat to the historic, you know, racial supremacy and religious supremacy of the dominant group, so that there were, you know, massacres, mass rapes and kidnappings of the women, destruction of minority religious institutions or villages, and the creation of these refugee populations that then had a famine and typhus and other forms of disease and died in droves. So I think that's a lesson that we can look to in identifying other cases. But also, towards the end of the book, I identify a transition from state actors to non-state actors. And, you know, some of the Ba'athists who are responsible for the Kurdish Anfal genocide are now in ISIS. You know, some people say that the ISIS who came into Iraq was smaller than the ISIS that was waiting for them in Mosul, a lot of them were Ba'athists. So there's these rebel groups and non-state actors are becoming as dangerous or more dangerous of a threat as ministries of the interior of states used to be.
My last question, we mentioned the title of this book. Is there any website or other writings that you can refer our listeners to?
I have a website. If you Google my name and the word SSRN, Hannibal Travis SSRN, there's a social science research network. It has a lot of my writings in PDF to download for free. And if you just Google my name, you get my official bio, which has links to all my books and articles. So I would say those are the two best ways.
Well, thank you very much, Hannibal. Really interesting and fascinating, an area of the world that people, at least in the United States,
I appreciate
aren't very
the opportunity.
Aware of.
Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.